This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
I'm David Aronovich. Welcome to The Briefing Room, the space in the metaverse where you, me, the top experts, and a big subject get together for 28 minutes. This week, Sir Keir Starmer says if Labour wins the next election, it will abolish the House of Lords and replace it with an elected second chamber. But such reforms are almost impossibly tricky. Will this be any different? We have been here before, several times. Almost everyone can agree on the need for some reform, but no one can agree on what that reform should be. So, first principles. Why do we need a second chamber at all? And why is it so hard to get consensus on what one should look like? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. Firstly, and inevitably, some history. Why was the House of Lords set up in the first place? What purpose was it intended to serve, and what changes has it seen over the years? Joining me in the briefing room is Professor Andrew Blick, Professor of Politics and Contemporary History at King's College London. Andrew Blick, let's go back to the beginning. When was the House of Lords actually set up, and what was it supposed to be for?
As is the case with lots of these things, it's very difficult to establish a precise point at which anything comes into being. But if we're looking to the earliest emergence of what we now call the House of Lords, it's useful to think of a body called the Witan, which existed pre-conquest times. It was a group of advisors that was convened by Anglo-Saxon monarchs, including some of the senior people from within their kingdoms and some of their maybe senior advisors and things like that, to give them advice and to ratify and to a degree legitimise their decisions and edicts. So that's the very beginning of it. After the Norman Conquest, 1066, monarchs rely on a smaller body, but nonetheless they still carry on convening what's sometimes known as the Grand Council. And then by the 13th century, we see really the beginnings of what becomes known as Parliament. So that's the backstory to it. It's quite a long and gradual tale of emergence, but we can trace that really up to the present day House of Lords.
Also looking at it historically in the later modern period, what was the House of Lords' relationship with the House of Commons? If we say go back to the period of the Georges, the Hanoverians and then Victoria.
Well, gradually, particularly in the period after the so-called Glorious Revolution of 1688, the House of Commons increasingly starts to assert itself. Its membership is elected and potentially that gives it a legitimacy that the House of Lords doesn't have because they're not elected. That issue really starts to assert itself during the course of the 19th century when from 1832 onwards we start to see these expansions in the franchise. And by 1928 we have equal franchise. Everybody in society's got the vote on the same terms with some exceptions. So that's a big change because it means the House of Commons has got this growing legitimacy that House of Lords doesn't have, and it can bring the two into conflict. We have a House of Lords with basically a large majority for the Conservatives amongst the hereditary peers, and then from time to time we have a Liberal government with a majority in the House of Commons out of which the government is formed, coming into conflict with each other, not being able to agree over legislation.
Now, in this period before the 20th century, did the House of Lords have the capacity to actually legislate? Could it actually pass laws itself? Could it actually tax?
Before 1911, in legal terms, the House of Commons and House of Lords had the same powers. There were various understandings developing that the Lords perhaps should give way to the House of Commons. But as is often the case with those kind of understandings, there wasn't agreement over what they actually meant in practice. So this led to conflict.
And tell us what happens in 1911.
In 1911, after a prolonged struggle between a Liberal government with a majority in the House of Commons after its big landslide election victory of 1906 and the Conservative-dominated House of Lords, eventually this comes to a head when the famous 1909 so-called People's Budget, introduced by David Lloyd George as Chancellor of the Exchequer, is rejected by the House of Lords. They've then crossed a line and there's an outright battle going on. And in 1910, there are even two general elections to try and sort all of this out. In the end, we arrive at the Parliament Act of 1911, which completely excludes the Lords from touching financial measures, budgets, and also means that in most instances, if the House of Commons is determined, it can overrule the House of Lords. So there's a shift from equal powers moderated by conventions to an actual hard legal limitation on what the House of Lords can do.
And so the Lords becomes what?
The House of Lords, in that sense, becomes more of an advisory and delaying chamber with the real legitimacy resting with the House of Commons.
And broadly speaking, does the Parliament Act of 1911 still define the relationship between the Commons and the Lords?
The legal relationship between the two is very much defined by that, as amended by the 1949 Parliament Act, which reduces further the amount of time the House of Lords can actually delay a piece of legislation for.
Now, turning to the actual membership of the House of Lords, for large parts of its history, it's almost entirely hereditary, apart from the bishops of the Church of England. How has that changed since, well, I was born in 1954. How has it changed since I was born?
Well, when you're about 4 years old, 1958, the Life Peerages Act was passed. That created a potential for the appointment of people who would sit in the House of Lords for life. And I say people because that's the point at which women are admitted into the House of Lords. Another big change comes in 1999, a bit later, where the Labour government, elected in 1997, excludes all but 92 of the hereditary peers. So we're now seeing a real shift away from this idea of a hereditary aristocratic chamber towards an appointed chamber.
So did the Labour government do everything that it said it was going to do to the House of Lords?
I think they said they were going to exclude all hereditaries. They didn't do that. But also, that reform was very much presented as a first stage, that there would be a second stage that would look more seriously at composition. In fact, if you look at the 1911 Act, the preamble to the 1911 Act makes it very clear that that act is intended as a kind of holding measure until they can move to what would effectively was intended to be an elected chamber. That was 1911. Still, 1911 still hasn't happened now. But Labour were talking about a second stage. But after innumerable white papers, reports, votes on multiple options, basically nothing really happened. Although one significant thing did happen. Another exception to who was sitting in the Lords who wasn't hereditary was the Law Lords, the people who made up what was in fact the senior court in the country. They were moved out under the Constitutional Reform Act 2005 into what became the UK Supreme Court. So that's a significant shift. And when we think about who was and wasn't in the House of Lords and what the House of Lords did and didn't do, that's an important thing to bear in mind. But it's a long way short of an elected second chamber.
So if you wondered what had happened to the Law Lords, that's your answer. What happens to reform attempts subsequently?
The next significant reform attempt, and there have been many that have fallen by the wayside along the decades, but the next significant one comes with the coalition government, the Liberal Democrat Conservative coalition government formed in 2010. Part of the coalition deal was that they would introduce House of Lords reform, including the plan they set out for a mainly elected second chamber. In 2012, they bring forward a white paper, but basically it can't get the support that's needed to get it through Parliament. And there's a significant point to all of this is that often the resistance to having an elected House of Lords, an elected second chamber, comes from the first chamber, the House of Commons, because MPs in the House of Commons don't necessarily want to create a second chamber that might challenge their legitimacy and their power by becoming elected.
Let's look at today. Who's in there now? How many of them are there and who are they?
If you go on the House of Lords website, it will tell you there are about 800.
So it doesn't know exactly.
It's quite a hard thing to keep track of, I believe.
Right. So roughly then, how is it composed? I mean, how many hereditaries are left?
There are 92 hereditaries left. Then there are crossbenchers who don't have any formal party affiliation. Then there are members of the different parties. I believe the SNP don't take up peerages, but you've got the Lib Dems, you've got Labour, you've got the Conservatives. One pattern which has established itself at the moment is that no one party has a majority in there. So it means that in that sense, it acts as a kind of a check on the government that you can't have a scenario in which you've got a majority in the House of Commons and also got a majority in the House of Lords.
Andrew Blick, that's how we got here. Now, given that Labour says it is committed to major reform, where might we go? With me in the briefing room are Meg Russell, Professor of British and Comparative Politics and Director of the Constitution Unit at University College London, Patrick Diamond, Associate Professor of Public Policy at Queen Mary, University of London, and Jess Sargent, Senior Researcher at the Institute for Government. Meg Russell, what do other countries do for second chambers?
Well, I suppose, first of all, you have to say not all countries have second chambers, but a good number of them do, and particularly the larger democracies do. So they're very common around Europe, in Commonwealth countries like Canada and Australia, India, South Africa, Japan. There are over 70 second chambers around the world, and they are very, very varied institutions. So we think the House of Lords is weird, and in some regards, it obviously is weird, but it's not weird having a second chamber that isn't entirely elected. Actually, only about a third of the second chambers around the world are entirely directly elected by the people. Some of them are indirectly elected by subnational government. Some of them have appointed members and other forms of membership, and a lot of them are mixed. A lot of them combine these different forms of membership. And the point of the second chamber is really to try and capture dimensions of representation that are not readily captured in the first chamber, to be complementary to the makeup of the first chamber and to do complementary things.
Why? Why do you need complementary things if you've had an elected first chamber?
There's something fundamental, very basic, that is useful in second chambers, that they slow the process down. So the first chamber considers something, it might get into the newspapers, maybe interest groups outside begin to hear about the policy. They then get concerned, and if it was about to be signed off, they wouldn't be able to have a conversation. If it then passes to a second chamber, there's another place where it can be discussed, and people there come at it from a different and complementary angle and maybe raise points that the first chamber hadn't thought about.
Patrick, is it the case then that we shouldn't think about this in terms of the famous phrase checks and balances? Because that doesn't sound like checks and balances. It just sounds like, excuse me for a moment, First Chamber, have you thought about this?
Well, I think, as Meg says, there is a lot of variation in the role that second chambers play across the larger democracies in the world, but there are some similarities. And I think one key role of most second chambers is that they provide alternative sources of opinion, and they also can provide a check on the primary legislature. There are also important differences. As Meg says, there are these hybrid second chambers. What's, I think, relatively unusual about the UK is that it is entirely appointed, and appointed often through procedures which many people consider to be not very transparent. So I think in that sense, the UK is somewhat different to other parts of the world, but not entirely different, of course.
Jess Sargent, isn't there a kind of central dilemma here, which is if your second chamber doesn't do much, then what's it for? And if it does a lot, isn't it in competition with the first chamber?
Absolutely. I think that is the central tension, and that's part of the debate that we're having about reform. If one of the criticisms of the House of Lords is that it's not democratically legitimate, which from a point of democratic principle might be considered an imperfect scenario. But at the same time, because it's not legitimate, it exercises this sort of self-restraint in which it still defers to the Commons as the primary chamber. It will raise issues, as Meg said, and ask the House of Commons to think again, but it will prevent itself from pushing too far or exercising the full extent of its constitutional powers. So then you get the challenge, if you make that chamber more legitimate, and potentially if, for example, you're looking at an elected chamber that's elected by a different electoral system that might be more proportionate to how people are voting, do you then empower it to challenge the House of Commons even further and create this scenario where you might have gridlock over pieces of legislation that makes it difficult to govern?
So what can we say, given all that, Meg, about what the House of Lords currently does well and badly. And I know making this evaluation sounds like you're kind of having to have a big opinion, but if we were to try and create a consensus about what it does well and badly, where would it sit?
Well, the things which people generally cite are, first of all, its contribution to the legislative process, that it takes a second look at all bills, and it often gets much more engaged with the kind of technical detail and the issues of implementation than the House of Commons does. The House of Commons kind of does the big politics, and then the House of Lords often looks at sort of the technical, more boring aspects. And it makes a huge number of amendments. So Lord McFall, the Lord Speaker, gave a speech last night, and he cited figures from a recent session where the House of Lords made over 1,000 amendments to government bills in that session. And only 83 of those amendments were actual defeats of the government. Most of them were amendments that the government had made to its own legislation, having listened to the arguments in the House of Lords. So it's fairly well accepted that it helps out with the legislative process. It also questions ministers on the floor. You've got some quite challenging experts who ministers have to defend their policy in front of. And it has a system of specialist select committees, which are not like the committees in the Commons. They're not organised according to government departments. They cut across departmental boundaries, and several of them look at important constitutional aspects. So you've got the Constitution Committee, the Delegated Powers Committee, which are a lot to do with sort of non-partisan scrutiny of the use of executive power. And that's something the House of Commons doesn't do. So again, that's a very complementary role.
Patrick, what does it do badly?
Certainly for the opponents of the House of Lords, there's a long list. I think 2 points to make. One is, does the Lords really provide an effective check on executive supremacy or executive power? In some respects, it does. So in the Blair period, for example, between 97 and 2010, I think it's the case that the House of Lords defeated the government over 450 times, often on pieces of legislation where the executive was seen to be potentially overstepping its powers or perhaps undermining human rights, for example, anti-terrorism legislation, the imposition of ID cards. But is the House of Lords really able, and I think recent years may raise this question, is it really able to properly provide a check against executive supremacy and possible executive abuse of the Constitution? The evidence is it struggles to do that. And I think that also links to its legitimacy, concerns about the size of the House of Lords, concerns about how peers are appointed, the particular role that party donors seem to play in terms of being appointed to peerages. All of these factors have undermined the legitimacy of the Lords and therefore its capacity to provide that check and balance that we need in the Constitution.
Can I ask all three of you very quickly, are the people who are appointed to the Lords appointed because of their specific capacity to fulfil the functions that we've just said the Lords needs to fulfil? Jess?
Not necessarily. I mean, there are different mechanisms for appointing members. There are some members that are appointed by political parties. And recently we've seen quite a lot of controversy over the resignation honours of various prime ministers and some of the people on their list who some would argue perhaps don't have that level of expertise or experience that might be required to fulfil this role. There are other members, including crossbenchers, who are appointed by the House of Lords Appointment Commission, and their applications are assessed on the basis for them to fulfil this function. But I think the other thing we should pause on the House of Lords membership is that it's not very representative of the UK population. Only about a quarter of members are women. It's generally older than the average population. I think the average age is around 71. And we don't have statistics on diversity or regional balance. But again, you wouldn't necessarily expect that to reflect the population. Now, in one sense, that's not what it's meant to do. You could say that that's what the House of Commons is for. But certainly, I think it's something worth pausing on.
It's lovely to think that there's a significant body whose average age is even older than I am. Patrick, can we now look specifically at Keir Starmer's proposals to replace the House of Lords if Labour wins the election? Can you take us briefly through what it involves and in what way it's different from what's been suggested before?
So I think there are two distinctive aspects to the Commission proposals that Gordon Brown and Keir Starmer announced on Monday. One is that the role of the second chamber that's envisaged by these reforms would be distinctive in the sense that it would be, I think, what's described in the report as an assembly of the nations and regions of the United Kingdom. And I think this is a relatively new development in thinking about House of Lords reform, because rather than just thinking about what role should the second chamber play play within the legislative system, there's an attempt to answer a question about what role could the second chamber play in terms of the constitutional future of Britain in the context of us being a more devolved polity with Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland and English city regions needing to be incorporated within the governing and constitutional system. I think the second distinctive aspect is that in the past, many of the arguments about House of Lords reform have been arguments about form and composition. What this report at least attempts to do, I'm not saying it's got necessarily the right answers, is it tries to answer the question, what function should the second chamber fulfil within this broader constitutional reform?
Which is what, Meg? Which is one of actually broadening the representation in Parliament beyond what is actually there in the first chamber.
Can I first say, I would slightly challenge what Patrick said about this being a new idea, the idea of a second chamber of the nations and regions. If we go back even to the Royal Commission, which reported in the year 2000, it was proposing a kind of territorial role. And a lot of the proposals since have had that theme. And actually, the second chamber of the nations and regions, I think, first appeared in Labour's manifesto in 2010 and then again in 2015. So the Brown Commission is trying to flesh out something that Labour's been thinking about for a while. And it hasn't fleshed it out very much. It hasn't got much further than the definition. So it wants the chamber to be smaller and it wants it to be directly elected, those things we know, on a different electoral cycle to the Commons. But it doesn't say what electoral system, what electoral boundaries, those kinds of things, which are quite important. In terms of the role, it does suggest in a fairly vague way that the role of checking the government's legislation would actually be reduced, that the powers would be reduced, the current powers that the Lords has, which leads you to think, well, how are we going to compensate for that? Because that is what its central role at the moment. And then it suggests having more of a sort of oversight of the way that the devolution settlement works, of the constitution in general, perhaps more powers over a set of constitutional statutes. And yes, as has already been said, to make it more representative territory. But there are reasons why the House of Lords is not territorially representative at the moment. The way that people are paid there, they're not paid a salary, they don't get any staff, and in particular, they don't get any overnight allowances for travelling to London. So it's actually quite hard to take a seat in the House of Lords if you're not based in the South East or you haven't got independent income. So we could sort that out even in the current chamber.
Patrick, just practically, we've heard about the fraught history of attempts at second chamber reform. Does this require the party that's trying to push it through to have some enormous majority in Parliament to do it?
Well, certainly a decisive majority would help, but the chances of these proposals being successfully implemented are, of course, qualified by a range of factors, one of which is, will these proposals actually make it into the final Labour Party election manifesto or not? That's still, I think, a question to be decided. And, of course, how unified is the Labour Party about these proposals? There are many different views within the Labour Party about how the House of Lords ought to evolve in the future. There are those who favour abolition. There are those who favour some hybrid system. There are those who favour total election. There's actually a lot of division. And I also think, will the mood change if Labour gets into power? Because when ministers are confronted by the reality of having potentially a more influential House of Lords that could exercise in some areas more checks and balances and more scrutiny of the executive, will they actually be up for implementing that? So as things stand now, you know, several years away from the election, we might think that these proposals could be at the centre of Labour's programme. Things could look very different if Labour makes it into office.
Meg Russell, as one of our best-known constitutional experts, you must wrestle with this particular problem all the time, which is the argument that the public don't care about this, that any minute that a government spends dealing with this in power is a minute it doesn't spend on something that people really, really want. What do polls and any kind of measurement we can take of public attitude tell us about this?
There aren't many polls about the House of Lords, and several of them have been conducted by the Constitution Unit, commissioned by myself. The most recent one that we've done has asked people about the Lords as it is now and whether people think, for example, that it should have an unlimited size, as it currently does, or whether it should be limited at the size of the House of Commons. And there's overwhelming support for it to be reduced to the size of the House of Commons and no bigger. We've also asked people about whether the Prime Minister should continue to have the patronage power to put people in there or whether that should be given to some sort of independent commission. There's overwhelming support for an independent commission to have the power rather than the Prime Minister. When it comes to election versus appointment, we ask people whether it should have elected members because it would have democratic legitimacy, whether it should have appointed members because then you'd be able to have experts and people independent of party. And you get more or less an equal split on that.
Yesterday, Lord McFall suggested that a committee conduct a fundamental consensus-based review of workable options for the future of the House, which is an awful lot of qualifications in one sentence. Now, Jess, where do you think they should start if they're going to do this?
So I think the place to start is thinking about the functions that the House of Lords currently performs, which of those functions you want to maintain, which you might want to strengthen, and think about some of the barriers to the House of Lords currently performing those functions effectively, whether it be lack of legitimacy, whether it be some of the criticisms potentially around rules around lobbying or second jobs or those sorts of things, and think about how you can strengthen those. I mean, it's not clear to me exactly. Workable options is a slightly difficult phrase here, whether we are talking within the boundaries of the House of Lords as it's currently composed, or whether the review would look at a broader range of options, including the options of appointed or elected or a combination of the two, or even some radical options that some people propose around a sortition or a second chamber made up of members of the public. I think if we want to build support around a particular option, then I think it's important not to exclude any of those.
Patrick Diamond.
So I think the immediate reforms that could be carried out to the Lords would be obviously limiting the Prime Minister's powers of appointment to the chamber, also looking at the future of the hereditary peers, because of course, although the Blair governments did deal in part with the hereditary peers, there are still hereditaries serving in the House of Lords. Could you get a consensus on dealing with that issue? And also introducing stronger safeguards against, for example, abuses around lobbying in the House of Lords. All of these reforms would, I think, address public concerns. But there is a longer term question about the future of the Constitution and how well we're governed. And I think that that does speak to not necessarily kicking this into the long grass and just going for a piecemeal approach, but trying to think radically about the contribution that a second chamber makes to how well our democracy functions. And that brings us back to the core question of what is the House of Lords there to do and how effectively does it discharge those responsibilities?
But Meg Russell, earlier you said that there is a very useful series of functions for a second chamber to fulfil and necessary, which don't absolutely have to mean continuous conflict with the first chamber. What do you think should be done in order to enhance the capacity of the second chamber to fulfil those functions without having these kind of noisome problems which the current setup gives us?
Well, I think there are the obvious big questions about longer term reform and whether we want to go for something which strengthens the devolution settlement, which is more ambitious and so on. But I think if that's going to happen, it's going to take a good long time to work it out. I think the government, if it's a Labour government, will need to consult on that in detail. They can't do that straight away. So I think we need some straightaway reforms, which actually some of which a new Prime Minister could implement without even having legislation. Because of the extent of the patronage power, a Prime Minister who simply says, I'm not going to do that anymore, can achieve change. And the current Appointments Commission that we have simply acts on the instruction of the Prime Minister. So a new Prime Minister could say, I want to put a cap on the size. I want to have a proper formula for sharing out seats between the parties, because this is one of the things that drives the size continually up. And we could talk more about the quality of people going in being scrutinised by the Appointments Commission, even just publishing why people are being proposed and allowing the Appointments Commission to say whether they think they're going to be good members before they're appointed.
Do we not do that now?
Not for the parties, only for independent members.
So let me get this straight. The parties do not currently have to tell you what the attributes are of the people they are putting forward for peerages?
No, the Appointments Commission has a very limited role. All it does is check the so-called propriety of people. That is, it looks at their tax affairs and those kinds of things. It doesn't in any way make a judgment on whether they are suitable members, whether they're qualified, whether they're geographically diverse, demographically diverse. You know, have we got a fair number of men and women being appointed? That kind of thing. There are some really basic things the Appointments Commission could be asked to do by a Prime Minister on day one of a new government. And I think getting those things right would be a really good start while the consultation goes on.
Meg Russell with Patrick Diamond and Jess Sargent. My thanks to them and to Andrew Blick. We'll be back at the same time next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Ben Carter, Kirsty Knight and Daniel Gordon, and the editor was Simon Watts. The programme was mixed by James Beard. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon, but if you enjoyed it, you can find many others on BBC Sounds, like the one on how the UK is getting on with negotiating free trade deals, the one about whether Vladimir Putin might use nuclear weapons, and the one about whether the crypto bubble is bursting.
Hello, I'm Anita Arnand and I'm hosting this year's BBC Wreath Lectures, which are on the subject of freedom. The lectures are inspired by Franklin D. Roosevelt's famous Four Freedoms speech. And this year, we have not one, but four speakers.
We look forward to a world founded upon four essential
human freedoms.
The first is freedom of speech and expression.
The second is freedom of every person to worship God in his own way.
The third is freedom from want.
The fourth is freedom from fear.
A quartet of speakers examine what freedom means today, beginning with the best-selling author Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie.
Freedom of speech is, I think, essential to being human.
You can hear all the lectures on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. Just search for The Wreath Lectures.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.